Shrink Wrap Radio number 586, The Upside of Shame, with Vernon Kelly Jr., MD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Vernon Kelly Jr., MD, who, along with psychotherapist Mary Lamia, is the co-author of the 2018 book, The Upside of Shame, Therapeutic Interventions Using the Positive Aspects of a Negative Emotion. And that will be the topic of our discussion. For more information about Vernon Kelly Jr., MD, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Vernon Kelly Jr., welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you. And you've let me know that you like to be called Vic. So we'll keep that in mind if I need to address you directly. I'm really happy to have you on the show. The publisher had sent me a flyer with the title of your book, which I got very excited about. And the title, as you know, is The Upside of Shame, Therapeutic Interventions Using the Positive Aspects of a Negative Emotion. And that the reason that got me excited was I had the impression that shame has gotten sort of a bad rap among therapists, although I hadn't read anything about that. But your title suggests that shame has an upside. Not only does it suggest it, it says it right outright. So why has shame been so marginalized in our field? What can you tell us about that?
It's a very good question. I think shame was seriously marginalized until about the 1980s, 1990s, although Helen Block Lewis's work on shame, I don't remember the exact year, I think was in the 80s, could have been in the late 70s or the 80s. And Leon Wurmser did some work on shame. But mostly shame was seen and still is by a large, by virtually everybody. Shame is seen as a negative emotion because the feeling of being ashamed is so dramatically unpleasant for everybody. What happened was
part of the message that I got about it was that that's a superfluous emotional baggage, and you just don't need to be carrying that around.
Right. That's exactly right. And if you think that way and have a theory of human emotion that's based on that, then you miss the upside of shame. And I was never tuned into it until my late colleague Don Nathanson and I began working on a book about shame and eventually discovered the rather brilliant American psychologist, philosopher, writer, Sylvan Tompkins. Tompkins spent his entire life working on what he called human being theory. In search of the question, what do human beings really want? And in his work, which also is related very much to studies of Darwin, the neuropsychological psychiatric findings of his time, his first two books were published in the early 1960s. He decided that the affect system, of which shame is a part, evolved as a survival mechanism for our species many, many years ago, and that each of the nine affects had a specific evolutionary function to help with survival.
Now, what's the difference between affect and emotion? Because I've always tended to use them synonymously. And in your book, there seems to be some differentiation there.
Yeah, the affects as defined by Tompkins are innate phenomena. everybody is born with 9 of these innate phenomena, which as time goes by in our relationships with our caregivers and the world around us, each of the emotions becomes, each of the affects becomes an emotion or a series or family of emotions based on our experiences.
So I want to make sure I understand this.
An innate affect is something that is essentially triggered like a knee-jerk response.
Okay.
Whereas an emotion is something that's much more complex. It's kind of a combination, if you will, of biography and biology. Okay. The innate affects are pure biology.
Okay. Now, is this widely accepted? Is this broadly accepted, or is this approach pretty unique to Tompkins?
Well, the approach was initially very unique to Tompkins. There are a fair number of people who now accept it. One of the serious problems with the field, both of neurology, neuropsychiatry, neuropsychology, is that there is really no consistent, settled upon theory of affect and emotion.
Okay. You mentioned that there are 9 affects.
Yeah.
Can you rattle them off off the top of your head?
Absolutely. Okay. There are 2 positive affects. Tompkins saw a range for each of these affects. The interest and excitement is the first. The second is enjoyment, joy. These are positive affects. There's a neutral affect, surprise, startle, which really is kind of like a resetting mechanism for the brain, preparing for what comes next. Might be followed by positive affect, and it might be followed by negative, depending on what happens next.
Uh-huh.
Important to recognize that each of the innate affects is a very short-lived phenomenon. Happens like that. Okay. Now, the negative affects, of course, there are 6 because it's the human condition, and there must be more negative than positive. The negatives are distress, anguish, which is ultimately the foundation for the generic term depression. Then there's anger, rage. There is fear, terror. There is disgust. There is the only affect, innate affect that Tompkins developed a neologism for, which is dissmell, D-I-S-S-M-E-L-L, which is the turning away from something which is rotten, smells rotten. And then the final one, and probably the last to evolve, according to Tompkins' thinking, is the affect of shame, humiliation.
Now, I notice you're using word pairs for many of these.
It's a range.
So that's kind of anchors the 2 ends of the range.
Exactly.
Like fear, rage, was it? Fear, rage?
Fear, terror.
Or fear, terror, anger, rage.
Anger, rage.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
good. So there is a range for each of the affects, with the exception of disgust and dismal, there is a range.
Okay. So evolutionarily, these were what part of, we needed these for as survival mechanisms, is that?
Yeah, if you think of the early species, the early dilemma faced by whatever part of our developmental flow as a species, we were faced with a situation where the world had a lot of stimuli in it, visual, auditory, smell, taste, touch, feel. And the question is, what is the most important stimulus for us to pay attention to at any split second in time in order for us to simplify the way in which we handle this cacophony of stimuli with which we were faced?
Mm-hmm.
Tompkins followed one of the things that Darwin did, which was that Darwin sent questions to his emissaries around the world, asking various questions about the facial responses. For instance, he said, in your part of the world, when somebody is happy, do the corners of the mouth turn up, in other words, in a smile, and the eyebrows raise? And the many months later, as he received responses from his emissaries, the answer was yes. No matter where they were, no matter the race that they were engaged with. And Darwin thought that this was by no matter means a consequence. Well, Tompkins saw from the work of Darwin that, and studied faces very, very carefully for many, many years, that amongst the species around the world, we all have the same nine innate affects. For instance, Paul Ekman, who was a colleague and a student of Tompkins, Ekman took pictures to various places around the world, and he took a picture picture of a man with his head down and the obvious face of shame. All of us would say, all of us Caucasians would say, oh, that's a embarrassed man.
If you want to, you can just tell him I'm busy now or something if you need to.
Well, I will if they keep at it.
Okay.
My apologies. That's a phone that can't be shut off.
Sure.
Unfortunately. Well, one of the places that Paul Ekman went was a place where they had really not seen Caucasians, this particular tribe. It was a fishing tribe in a fishing village. And they showed the fishermen a picture of the face of the man having a shame reaction. And the tribal response was, oh, we know what that man feels. That's the face of a man who has caught no fish today.
Hmm.
Which, of course, would be the greatest embarrassment for the fishermen in the village.
Uh-huh.
So these faces and these facial expressions are universal. And now that we have the kind of technology that we have, I don't think anybody has any trouble recognizing somebody from the other side of the world, telling whether that person is angry, whether that person is happy, whether that person is sad. We see it in the face, which Tompkins saw as the primary, organ of the affect system.
You know, I think a little bit of a digression is there's been some stuff on the internet about, I don't know if you ever go to YouTube and you've seen these videos of dogs feeling shame, expressing what we interpret as shame. There's some debate now as to whether that's an anthropomorphism on our part and some questioning of whether or not dogs do feel shame. Does that fit into this discussion at all?
Well, absolutely. If you look up the species, as the species move up to us, who are right now considered the top of the mammalian line, which may or may not be correct. We'll find that out over time, won't we? But absolutely. Dog owners will all tell you, oh, yes, I can tell when my dog is embarrassed. And you see something very similar to what happens with humans, which is the loss of muscle tonus in the neck and the eyes averted and turned to the side and looking down.
Yeah.
Very similar to the face of a child or even an adult who's experiencing shame. Yeah.
Yeah, it totally makes sense that there'd be some continuity along the mammalian chain, right?
Absolutely.
Up to us.
Let me just say one more word about the innate affects. Each one is a response to a specific set of stimulus conditions. For instance, surprise startle is a response to a sudden clap of thunder or flash of lightning or a gunshot. Okay, and you can sort of graph it in the way as if it were a square wave. And in the book, we made some effort to show some of these graphs. And the affect itself is an analog of the stimulus. So a stimulus of a sudden gunshot, if you graph the sound, would be a sharp up and down line, if you will, in the graph. Is that clear, David, I hope?
Yeah, a spike, I would call it, right? A spike.
And if you look at the facial response of surprise, startle, it's kind of like that.
Yeah.
Very much following that line. Now, the affect of distress, anguish, Tompkins saw as the response to too much happening for too long. Something in the above optimal range taking place in the surround of us or even inside of us, such as a pain or even hunger or a loud noise which won't stop, a drilling outside your door as they're breaking up the cement of your driveway, where we now then have to talk a little bit louder, and this then triggers the affect of distress.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the distress, in a way, is an analog of that, if I can put it into auditory. So the stimulus condition is an analog. The affect is an analog of the stimulus conditions.
So I'm trying to remember. Shame is one of the affects.
Is one of the innate affects.
Was there a pair, or it was a kind of
shame, humiliation?
Pardon?
Shame, humiliation is the
shame,
phrase.
Shame, humiliation. Okay.
I think you could even expand that to mild embarrassment, to mortification. All of which are in the shame family of emotions.
Okay, so there are a bunch of emotions that have shame at their root.
There is a vast family of emotions that has shame at the root, yes.
Yeah. Now, I'm wondering, is there good shame and bad shame?
That's a great question. The answer to that question is really an answer that involves intensity and situation, okay? If you are mildly embarrassed, say as a kid in school, about a problem that you can't quite get right, an answer that you can't give right in the class, if you're mildly embarrassed about that, and say, for instance, the teacher gives you a second chance, and you get it right, you feel great. If you go back and study later on and say, oh gosh, that was the answer, then the shame motivated you towards learning, towards understanding what you weren't getting right at that moment in time. If the teacher, say for instance, was somebody who taught by increasing the shame of a student, then that level of shame might reach humiliation, and the student might then withdraw from the whole situation, say, I don't give a darn about school, and I hate school, and all that kind of stuff, and go home and watch video games the rest of the night and learn nothing from it.
That would suggest that the shamers, whether they're parents or bosses or I was going to say therapist, but I don't know if therapists should be applying shame as a technique, as an intervention.
It's been done.
Huh?
It's been done,
yeah. So one would have to administer shame, if you will, very carefully, because you don't know for sure what the impact's going to be on the shamee.
Yeah, that's
on the person
exactly
who's
right.
being shamed. You know, taking from the example that you gave us of the kid who's, for whom it's motivational.
Mm-hmm.
So it can either be a motivational tool, as our society tries to do to us. You'd asked me a question when we first spoke on the phone, would you like to live in a shameless society? In some ways I feel like we already are, but I won't go into that. But in general, no, you don't want to live in a shameless society.
Yeah, shame is a very important affect to have evolved, if you will. Briefly, and it's a little confusing until one kind of studies it for a while and gets a handle on it, Tompkins' concept of the innate affect chain was that it was a mechanism that evolved to let us know when either of the two positive affects were being impeded in some way. In other words, if our interest in something was blocked by anything, shame would take place, or if our enjoyment of something was blocked in some way, shame would be triggered to give us the information that that event was taking place. Therefore, the upside of shame is that it, as a motivator, it attempts, its motivational power is to attempt to restore the prior state of interest or enjoyment, the prior positive state.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So, for instance, Don Nathanson's book, Shame and Pride, which came out in 1992, also a W.W. Norton book, just like The Upside of Shame. And they saw The Upside of Shame as a follow-up to Don's book, 1990 book, Shame and Pride. Don talked a lot about the shame-pride axis. Well, learning in many respects has a lot to do with the shame-pride axis. Okay, we feel pride when we learn something, when we're more competent at something, when we're better able to do something. And shame gives us the information, for instance, that we're not quite there, that our interest in writing perfectly, our interest in making that basket from the three-point range, our interest in whatever is somehow or another not quite where we want it. And shame says, okay, you're not quite there. And then motivates us when it's at a proper level of intensity and managed properly by, say, caregivers or teachers, educators, whatever, motivates us to try harder.
What's popping into my head is, having heard Japan often referred to as a shame-based culture, how does that fit in? Is that, I guess we see both of ends of that, if I can generalize, in the Japanese culture. On the one hand, extraordinarily motivated to be skillful in all things, but at the other extreme, committing seppuku, harikari, suicide. Right. So that sort of dramatically illustrates the two poles of shame.
Absolutely does. And the power of shame really is that. Careful study, once people get tuned into recognizing shame in various people, shows that an awful lot of suicides are shame-based, that the person reached the end, went beyond humiliation to mortification. Mm-hmm. And you certainly do see that with harikari in the Japanese culture, which is maybe the most powerfully shame-based culture around. But then again, you can't say that American culture is not shame-based to a large extent either. I mean, if you think about the shame-pride axis, and you look at the way advertising utilizes, you have to be the best and you have to be the happiest. And if you don't have this or you don't have that, you're not good enough. Mm-hmm. Then there's a lot of shame that goes on in terms of competition. I mean, again, there's a healthy kind of competition based on shame. I want to be better. I want to win this game. Okay. I want to hone my skills so I can be better. All right. And then there are people whose shame is leads them into a life of tremendous competitiveness with everything all the time forever, because they're always trying to prove themselves. Mm-hmm. Always trying to prove themselves.
So it's not, I'm getting the notion now that shame might be part of the dynamic in narcissism.
Shame is absolutely the most powerful, I think, dynamic in narcissism. Well described in the chapter in Narcissism in the Upside of Shame, a chapter written primarily by my co-author, Dr. Mary Lamia, who has a great deal of background in psychoanalytic theories of narcissism. And she goes into some interesting detail about how if we're informed by shame, we understand narcissism better. But let me, if I can back up and look at for just a minute, it might be helpful to think in terms of what happens when shame is too much.
Yeah.
What happens when we can't use the information that shame is giving us? Either we're not powerful enough to control the situation, or the person producing the shame in us is dominant over us in one form or another, or we don't have the freedom, or we don't have the intellectual capacity or the cognitive functioning yet to deal with the shame. If the shame is overwhelming, then shame defenses take over. These were again outlined by Don Nathanson in Shame and Pride, and he called it the compass of shame, because he saw in his research back to the 15th century four general libraries of defense against shame. And these four libraries were opposites, he thought, so he kind of called them the compass of shame to show a north, south, east, and west. And very briefly, they are attack other. It's not me who's wrong. It's not me who's doing anything wrong. It's you. The extreme of which is I'm going to kill you if you're not in order for me to feel better, I will outtalk you. I will kill you. I will whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Then there's attack self, which is the opposite. You know, I'm horrible. I'm awful. I'm terrible. Which would appear to be a shame increaser, but it's really a compromised position of I'm going to give myself the shame. I'm going to beat everybody else to the punch. Bless you. I'm going to beat everybody else to the punch and put myself down before you can, and that way I will control the amount of shame that I experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The negative sides of that, of course, are kind of our masochism, and in the long run, as we were discussing a little bit earlier, suicidal thoughts and behaviors, and even outright suicide. There's a very common defense mechanism called withdrawal. I'm just going to leave this situation. I won't go and give that speech because I know I'm going to mess it up and I'll be humiliated. So I'm just going to not show up. The extreme form of which ultimately is agoraphobia. And then there is the opposite side of that, which is avoidance denial. The mechanisms for which are, I'm smarter than everybody else in the world, so I'm never wrong. Hot, great, intense intellectualization, drugs and alcohol, all things which, in fact, allow the person to just ignore that they have any kind of vulnerability or shame whatsoever. So in the development of the narcissistic personality, what you see is kind of a mixture of avoidance denial. I'm not weak. I'm not helpless. I'm smarter than everybody else. I know everything. And attack other. And by the way, you're an idiot and you know nothing.
Boy, I don't know anybody like that. That doesn't bring anybody to mind. Tongue in cheek.
That's lucky.
It seems to me that there's a lot of shame usually around sexuality. Culturally, that's a big part of our history, and also for other periods and countries and so on.
Absolutely.
And I'm particularly mindful of a therapist friend of mine, friend acquaintance somewhere on that on that spectrum, who committed suicide, unfortunately. And I'm certain that it was because he felt so ashamed. He had done some sexual indiscretions that came out in the community that he was part of. And boy, that was just the beginning of a downward spiral.
I heard of another case just like that recently of a gentleman who everybody loved him, and he was very, very good to a lot of people. And unfortunately, with a high school student who was 16, he had committed some indiscretions, and his humiliation led him to suicide in jail. Hmm. Sexuality is an arena that is particularly vulnerable to shame because of the high level of interest. So that in general, the greater the level of interest which is being impeded or interfered with in some way, the greater the level of shame that somebody will experience. So if you, for instance, would make a comment at the height of, foreplay to your lover, let's say you mentioned something about cellulite.
God.
Heaven forbid.
Yeah.
That person is going to have a pretty powerful shame response, and that person's interest will be turned off.
I'm thinking about food and eating. There's a lot of interest innately in eating. And so the whole thing about weight and shame are pretty tightly married together, I think.
Absolutely. You have no argument for me there.
Yeah.
You'd have no argument for me there. And one of the other things about sexuality is that, you know, it's highly unlikely during sexual interactions that we can 1,000% mirror exactly where our partner is. And so it's very easy to do something that's just slightly off, as opposed to the very gross comment about cellulite, that momentarily is an impediment. Now, if we've got decent communication and we understand that moment of shame, that moment of turnoff, is just a piece of information, then we can communicate to our partner, no, that's not what I want, this is what I want. And the excitement goes back on again and things work well. And that, again, you see, that's the upside of shame. It's really primarily at its most basic innate root, information that something we're enjoying or something we're interested in is in some way being blocked. Let me just add, that needs to be distinguished from the fact that our interest may be gone. If we're no longer interested in something, then shame won't be triggered. There has to be positive emotion present for shame to actually be triggered. And in other words,
so if a person can focus on the positive that's in there and somehow learn to protect it, protect it or respect it, that'd be a good way to go.
Well, that's not a bad way to go. I mean, it really depends on the circumstance, obviously.
Yeah.
But if I'm often asked, I work a lot with couples. My first book, The Art of Intimacy and the Hidden Challenge of Shame, was from my experience working with couples over the years.
Is that what got you interested in shame in the first place?
Well, really, it was my work with Don Nathanson that got us involved heavily in shame. But yes, very much my work with couples did that. But also, I was originally trained in child psychiatry, too. So I had a fair amount of interest in shame in kids and parenting and educating kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
There's too much shame, yeah.
Yeah.
But in a couple, for instance, I'm often asked by somebody where a relationship has ended. And let's say the person I'm working with was not the one who ended the relationship, but the other person did. Shame that is triggered initially in that person is a feeling of rejection, feeling hurt. Okay, these are all shame. My interest in that person has been impeded by that person breaking up with me. Make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, as long as my interest in that person persists, I still feel hurt. I still feel rejected. I may well still feel lonely if it has caused me to withdraw from other people. I may be angry if it's causing me to attack other and say, what a horrible person that person was. I may be attacking self. Oh my gosh, I must have been a horrible person that they broke up with me. Or I may be going out and getting drunk every night to try and avoid and deny the entire thing. Mm-hmm. But if we, and that's the compass of shame in action. And all of us have done things on the compass of shame, David. In the upside of shame, we outline in borderline personality disorder, narcissism, anxiety, depression, ADHD couples, we outline where shame defenses, where the compass of shame defenses become mm-hmm. very, very problematic and cause very dysfunctional behavior in people or lots and lots of bad feelings. But back to the person who was rejected, apologize for the length of the story. The person will say to me, well, when am I going to get over so-and-so? And my answer is, when you meet the next so-and-so.
Right.
Because right. Now your interest in the old person will be ended. It will be there no longer. Now there is no mechanism for shame to be triggered, if you see what I mean.
And if you can get over it, but sometimes people really can't let go or have a big struggle absolutely. Letting go.
Absolutely. And in which case, you realize that they've got more deeply embedded shame scripts uh-huh. within their personality structure that more than likely reflect back to earlier relationships in their lives. And that then becomes the work of the therapy.
Let's imagine that maybe there's some listeners, viewers of our conversation here who are suffering with shame. We don't know over what, because as you've indicated, there can be quite a range.
Yeah.
What would be your recommendation to them in terms of their own internal processing? Yeah.
Well, the ultimate cure to shame, again, this is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, if you'll pardon me, is some form of exposure of it so that people can use the information that it provides in an environment which is shame-free, in an environment which is highly sensitive to shame issues, so that it is a compassionate environment, so that that person can re-examine for however how long it takes all of the negative self-thoughts and doubts and self-esteem issues and behaviors from that have taken place over the years. Validating the fact that the shame that they feel and have felt is real and that they have a chance now to expose to themselves and to a compassionate therapist the dynamics of what has happened to them, and they can begin to rework some of these things, recognizing shame wouldn't be there if there wasn't an upside on the other side. Mm-hmm. They want to do better, mm-hmm. look better, they want to feel better, they want to act better, they want to relate better, or they wouldn't have shame.
Yeah, finding that acceptance of a a listener who can hear it and accept it sounds like a powerful kind of an intervention. And it could be a therapist. It might be a 12-step program or some other kind of self-help or group therapy situation.
No question. The folks in AA are very tuned into shame. Once they stop drinking, of course, they've had a lot of shame about their drinking that has led them to AA in the first place, oftentimes. But they're very tuned in for sure.
Of course, right now we're having a major epidemic of drug addiction with these fentanyl and those opioids.
Yeah.
Synthetic opioids that are so powerful.
Very powerful.
So shame will be a big part of that picture in terms of people coming through the other side.
One of the reasons that Mary Lania and I wrote this book, particularly geared towards psychotherapists, is that if you Google shame books at Amazon or any place else, really the vast, vast, vast majority say, oh, shame is this bad thing that, we must get rid of in some way or another. And it was our feeling that those folks would be much better informed if they recognized, first of all, the inherited evolutionary function of shame, so they didn't make people feel shame for having shame.
If they can put it in a cognitive kind of framework to see that where it fits in the natural order of things.
Right, yeah. Right. There's a borderline personality disorder has traditionally been a very, very difficult disorder for the psychotherapeutic community. In Norway, John Monson, using the work of Sylvan Tompkins, developed a technique for treating people with borderline personality and others, severely ill people who were hospitalized, for suicide attempts and et cetera, et cetera, by literally just mirroring and validating each and every affect that person had, and teaching them along the way. All sessions were about teaching them and validating each and everything that person felt. Hmm. Usually the folks with the borderline personality disorder have been told, you are wrong to feel the way you feel. Well, I believe that they may have inherited some biological vulnerability to an intensification of shame. The human affect system, the human brain, can have anomalies in it just like every other system.
Sure.
Biological system. And some of the folks, I believe, with borderline personality disorder inherited a vulnerability that when shame is triggered in them, rather than having a little bit of shame, say a level 10, they have a level of 1,000.
Wow. That's an interesting hypothesis.
Very difficult for them.
Yeah.
Very difficult.
What do we know about, speaking of the brain, are there certain centers of the brain that seem to be involved in the shame cycle?
Absolutely. I wouldn't deem myself a world's expert on the brain, but there are some of the more primitive centers of the brain are involved with the affect system, but with connections into the cortex and into the higher centers, such that there is a ongoing feedback mechanism in the central nervous system between our cognitive abilities and our basic innate affects, such that, as Tompkins said, we have a central image or blueprint that runs us all the time to maximize positive affect and minimize negative affect. And they're pretty complex systems.
Your book's subtitle implies that there are implications for therapists when it says therapeutic interventions using the positive aspects of a negative emotion. So for the therapists that are listening, what are the therapeutic interventions? I think you've implied them you've been saying, but maybe you could be a little more specific.
Well, we outlined different ones for each of the different disorders that we discuss. Mm-hmm. But for instance, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which I have worked with a lot over the years because of my interest in children and adolescent, and adult development in ADHD. Kids with ADHD, therapists who are treating people with ADHD need to be very sensitive to the shame that these kids have felt throughout their life, starting if they've been very hyperactive with some problems that they have presented to their parents in that they're all over the place, hard to manage, if you will. And it's quite a challenge for parents of very hyperactive ADHD kids, amongst other things, to protect the kids. I've heard stories of the kids opening the door when the car is on the highway.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Thank goodness they're now door locks.
Yeah.
And then when kids reach educational age of 4, 5, 6, and they can't sit still in school, and they can't stop themselves from blurting out. They're highly distractible. This is completely antithetical to virtually every school system that we currently have. Different teachers are different with these kids, but the teachers have another problem. They've got to manage a large classroom or something. So these kids are often disciplined, sent to the principal's office, et cetera, et cetera. So, and these kids have experienced a great deal of shame when they have gone to try and read. The classic story, of course, is, I read the first sentence, and then partway through the paragraph, I couldn't remember what the first sentence was. So I went back to the first sentence, and I read it again, and then partway through the paragraph, I couldn't remember what the first sentence was. Yeah. And finally, I decided, what the heck? So their interest in learning to read has been impeded, and they have a lot of shame. So one of the first things a therapist has to do is look at the dynamics on the compass of shame of the behaviors that these kids have adapted. Are they aggressive? Are they attack other kids? Are they withdrawn? Almost all of them do a great deal of attack self. I am stupid. I can't do anything right. I don't know what I'm doing. Nobody likes me because they can be hard to get along with. They're a group who have a lot of avoidance denial mechanisms. I'm always right. You're wrong. Shut up, Dad.
So what do you do as a therapist?
So what you do as a therapist, number one, is you recognize these behaviors as being motivated by shame. And you, in the environment where you are attempting desperately to help the child understand that the child has been right about having that shame. And the reason they've had that shame is because they've wanted to do better.
Mm-hmm.
And that there are people who have had ADHD, like Branson, who founded Virgin Airlines, who's done very well. Like Michael Jordan, for instance, who says that he believes he has ADHD. Who has done very well, and a whole slew of people that can be, and that information can be found at ADHD websites, and say to these kids, look, you've got something you were born with. Everybody is telling you to control it. You can't necessarily control it all the time. Let's talk about the fact that you feel bad about this because you really want to do better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you're attempting to reduce shame right away.
Yeah, great. Tell us about another category.
In couples work, virtually all of the fights that couples get into are about the problems that evolve. Gee, this is a long answer, David. How much time do we have?
as much as you need, more or less.
Well, I wrote a bunch about attachment and attachment theory based on Tompkins's insights into affect, I'm trying to expand some on Bowlby's work and Ainsworth's work, showing that it is affect, it is interest that causes us to form the very earliest of connections with our caregivers. And because that's what we have. We don't have cognition particularly to start with. Mm-hmm. We have those affects that we are born with. And ultimately, the bottom line is that we become interested in others being interested in us. And we become interested in other people and interested in their interest, in our interest, in their interest in them. There are multiple layers of interest in human interpersonal relationships and enjoyment as well. When couples work, they work because positive affect has led them to one another in one way or another. We'll probably never be able to know all the mechanisms involved into why we connect with one person and not another, but nonetheless, that happens. And so we are interested in that person, and we are interested in that person being interested in us. There are, in any given day, you may have experienced this with your own wife, many things that can impede that interest. Much of the time, when things are going well, we feel a little mini shame response, and we feel a little frustrated, maybe a little hurt, a little this, a little that. If the relationship's going well, we use that information from the shame to reconnect, to bring the interest back. Dysfunctional couples who come to therapy, of course, something has ramped up the level of intensity of the negativity, and you see a lot of attack other taking place, a lot of withdrawal taking place. If the therapist understands shame and sees the mechanism that shame takes place as a mechanism to motivate us to restore our emotional connection, and the therapist can reinterpret the compass of shame behaviors that are driving people apart and making them worse, okay, then the therapist can utilize the information about shame and say to people, of course you're having a bad time, you're supposed to, you're not well connected emotionally, and all that's happening is that you're getting a feedback on that information all the time from shame affect.
Okay, well, people are going to need to get this book if they want to understand it in more depth, and particularly therapists will want to pay attention to those chapters in which you have specific recommendations for specific disorders. So maybe this is a good place for us to wrap it up. Do you have any concluding remarks that you'd like to make as we bring this to a close?
What you just said is really right on the money. That there is the work that Tompkins did was multi-complex theory of human personality. The affect system is just the motivational system part of it. He had a great deal of work he did on the cognitive system and the development of what are called scripts, which are repetitive ways which we learn and develop in our personality so that we all end up caring about everything and affect at the basis of it. And it's a very different paradigm from what most of us were either brought up believing in our families or you know, our cultures, or certainly even in the culture of being taught in a shrink school or psychology school or therapy schools of all kinds. It's a different way of perceiving what motivates human behavior, and it's well worth some study.
Okay, well, you're a good proponent of that. And Vic Kelly, I want to thank you, Dr. Vic Kelly, Dr. Vernon S. Kelly Jr. I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, David, thank you very much for having me. This was fun.
My guest today, Dr. Kelly, describes embarrassment as being on the low side of the shame spectrum. I guess I would have to confess to being on that end of the spectrum, in as much as I'm embarrassed to say I haven't previously heard of the philosopher/psychologist Sylvan Tompkins. As you may have gathered from the interview, Dr. Kelly's book on the upside of shame draws heavily on Tompkins' work. I don't recall ever having heard of Tompkins before or even any reference to him. I did look him up on Wikipedia. It's not like he's some old obscure figure from long ago. According to Wikipedia, Sylvan Solomon Tompkins lived June 4th, 1911 through June 10th, 1991. He was a psychologist and personality theorist who developed both affect theory and script theory. Following the publication of the third volume of his book, Affect Imagery Consciousness, in 1991, his body of work received renewed interest, leading to attempts by others to summarize and popularize his theories. There are also several websites dedicated to Tompkins' work, among them the Tompkins Institute. And I also see that over the course of his career, he was associated with Harvard University, Princeton University, CUNY Graduate Center, and Rutgers University. So Shrink Wrap Radio taught at least one person today, me. I'm impressed with the degree of detail that Drs. Kelly and Lamia bring to their examination of shame. I think their chapters on the role and treatment of shame in anxiety disorders, depression, narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, ADHD, and couples therapy will be of particular interest to you therapists and aspiring therapists out there. I recommend this 2018 book, The Upside of Shame, Therapeutic Interventions Using the Positive Aspects of a, quote, negative emotion. If you decide to purchase it, I hope you will use the Amazon widget in our right-hand sidebar to do that. Just click on one of the two book ads from the Amazon widget near the top of that sidebar, and then you'll be able to search for that title.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is just to let you know that I really appreciate your show across the ocean here in the Netherlands. I've expressed that by a small donation. With regard to the work you put into your shows, it's just a small amount, but it's another way to say I value what you do. I'll keep listening with heart and mind.
Thank you, Joris, there in the Netherlands. Your ongoing donation, along with those of others, makes such a difference. And thanks for letting other listeners know why you've made that choice. I really appreciate it. And I'm happy to report that we do have some new donors. My thanks go out to Ted Leike. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right. Leike, Catherine Hughes, and Heidi Virschup. Next week, my guest will be Jungian analyst Michael Gellert, and we'll be discussing his 2018 book, The Divine Mind. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. We'll be right back.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.